This is Talking Points, Kent's politics podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Talking Points, Kent's politics podcast. You're with me, Oliver Kemp, and our political editor, Paul Francis. How are you doing, Paul?
Good, thanks.
So, it's a week of interesting developments throughout Kent. We had a racing gambling advert, Lib Dem scuffles, and a cat standing in Medway. I think it's safe to say it's been a very interesting week in politics. We, of course, now know who each candidate will be in every area of the county standing for the general election on the 12th of December. We'll be talking about some of them in today's episode, but if you want a full rundown of who you can vote for on December 12th, you can find everything you need to know at kentonline.co.uk. And now our bosses will be happy because we've plugged the website.
It's always good to keep the bosses happy.
Exactly. So, Paul, give us a little bit of rundown on what you've thought about the last week in politics in Kent.
Well, it's all been about Canterbury, really, since the election was called, and a kind of bewildering series of events, in fact, that I've never really experienced in any election campaign, involving candidates standing, candidates not standing, candidates apparently disappeared over mountain ranges, unable to confirm whether they're standing or not. So Canterbury has definitely been where it's all at in the first full week of the campaign.
Paul on Politics, your show on KMTV ended up being sort of the centre of it. We talked about it last week. You had Tim Walker on, who was standing for the Lib Dems. We had Rosie Duffield on, and obviously there was a bit of a discussion there on why hasn't there been a pact made in this area, bearing in mind Rosie won, but it was very marginal last time. It was a historic win for Labour in Canterbury. And Tim Walker sort of discussing, no, we're still going to stand because we're the only party that is the beat Brexit party. Now we saw him drop off and decide to stand down.
Yes, and we shoulder some of the blame for this, I think, or shoulder some of the responsibility. Because just a bit of background to what happened, we had, as you say, the Rosie and Tim on the show. And after the show, Tim was going back to Canterbury, and Rosie, who'd arrived by train from London, was going to get a train. So Tim very chivalrously said, oh, well, I'll tell you what, why don't you get a lift with us? So Rosie accepted, and they ended up having a longer than expected conversation in the car because there was some traffic jam along the M2. And it was at that point that Tim decided he didn't really have the stomach for the fight. So having stood for all of about a week, he then decided to throw in the towel. And that led to a certain sense of panic in the Lib Dems quarters. And they were kind of hurriedly parachuting in a new candidate from Dorking, a woman called Claire Malcolmson.
Yes. And then I guess after that, it looked as if it'd be interesting to see what Claire had to say and how she would stand in a different way to Tim Walker. And then obviously we had another development, which we covered on Kent Online, which was a rather racy gambling advert that was discovered from her past life as an actor.
Yes, Claire is an actress by profession, and one of her previous jobs was to have a gig, as it were, as in this advert for a gambling company. Which, as you say, that word racy, often used by tabloids but by nobody else, came to the fore. It showed her in some interesting dresses.
Yeah, costume. I think it'd be safe to say it was S&M gear and a whip.
Yes, let's put, there's no bones about it, that's absolutely right.
We're going to go with exactly what it was. There's
no, let's not dance around the description.
No.
So this story appeared and, you know, got a few comments, but I think the problem that the Lib Dems have, to be serious for a moment, in Canterbury is that they've been seen to be a bit all over the place, and there's been lots of internal recriminations within the association about the fact that they've had to find a replacement, and the National Party apparently insisted that there should be a candidate, whereas there was a lot of feeling that the Lib Dems perhaps ought to stand aside to give Rosie Duffield the best chances of retaining the seat. So it's all got a bit messy for the Liberal Democrats, but it's also got a bit messy for the Brexit Party, because they too have had some difficulties in Canterbury. Their candidate, Owen Prue, was amongst the candidates that was nominated, well, he wasn't nominated, but was picked by the party and was going to be the only constituency in Kent where there was going to be a Brexit Party candidate. Now, come Friday, or Thursday, I beg your pardon, when the nominations were published, we saw that his name wasn't on the list of candidates for Canterbury. And it was, we've only just been able to establish a little bit about what happened there. He decided, he says he decided not to stand, sent a long open letter explaining his reasons, although not in a terribly coherent fashion, but basically he was saying he decided to stand aside because he was alarmed at the prospect of Jeremy Corbyn becoming leader and he wanted people to back the Conservative candidates, Anna Firth. That's put it very simply. His letter has lots of literary allusions and it's slightly more cryptic than that, but he tweeted out that the reason he stood aside was because he wanted a Conservative government and felt that Jeremy Corbyn wasn't the right person to lead the country.
Mm.
So it's kind of in, out, do the hokey-cokey, all in Canterbury.
Yeah, it's becoming, and obviously in the last general election, it ended up being one of the national stories that kind of put the general election into Kent on a national scale, and could potentially do the same thing again. It certainly ended up being a lot of our focus in the last week because of so much that's going on. I mean, just slightly going back to, you know, not wanting to take it down a level, but going back to the Claire Malcolmson video.
Yes, let's bring it down.
Bring it down, why not? Monday morning. I mean, there's been discussion on whether this might damage her credibility, and she even said when she was asked about it, this could damage my credibility. Yeah. I mean, do we think that's what's going to happen?
Well, I think, you know, how prurient are we going to be over this sort of thing? You know, it was a job. She has to make a living. If she's not getting acting roles, you know, lots of actors do this kind of stuff. Nothing unlawful or illegal was taking place. So, you know, maybe it's a little bit of a fuss about nothing. But, you know, and also, let's be honest about it, it might be the sort of thing that might win her a few votes.
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at the Liberal crowd, who, and let's be honest, it's perfectly fine to make a living. It's not, she's not done anything illegal here. This was just a job.
Yeah. There are worse things that candidates have done.
Exactly, far worse things. So I think it'll be interesting to see if that does affect it. But then I suppose when it comes to who wins votes on the night, it's going to be very difficult to come to any conclusion as to whether that's affected her campaign or not. Anyway, really.
I think if there's going to be any impact on the Liberal Democrats, it is the fact that they've had to parachute somebody in at late notice who doesn't know the area, is not embedded in Kent, has no real Kent connections at all. And, you know, for the Liberal Democrats, that's a big, you know, big thing for them, is they, as it's sometimes said, they're a bottom-up rather than a top-down party. But they've had to, you know, deal with an unexpected turn of events and have probably ended up with a candidate who is going to do far less well than Tim Walker was going to do. But, you know, let's a bit of balance. Tim Walker was also not from Kent and was an outsider.
Well, this is the thing about your local MPs. You presumably want them to understand the area, know the area, so they can best represent you and help improve the local area, not just being parachuted in.
And most parties have done that in Kent. They have got local candidates. It's quite unusual to have you know, candidates installed at that late stage, you know, like 24 hours before the nomination papers were.
Yeah, that's particularly late.
So, you know, the local association members, activists and, you know, supporters within the association were apparently very unhappy, or a lot of them were very unhappy about it. And, again, just a bit of background, just so happened that the constituency party was supposed to be having its annual general meeting last Thursday, timing-wise, and had suggested that it be cancelled because they were going to be busy with lots of other things. I can't think what that was a reference to. But I gather from my contacts that went down like a proverbial lead balloon, because they realised that activists and, you know, association members would want to give vent to their feelings about the whole sorry episode.
Talking Points, Kent's politics podcast.
So a report came out today. It's been reported on a number of different areas of the press about how Muslim voters could swing certain marginal seats in the country, and one of them was Canterbury. I mean, it seems like Rosie Duffield's been pretty good with the Muslim community. She's been turning up to a lot of events, and the chair of the Muslim mosque in Canterbury told me that her previous, the previous person who was MP, Julian Brazier, never turned up to any events, therefore felt perhaps there would be some more votes on the cards this time around for Rosie Duffield from the Muslim community in Canterbury. I mean, how important do you think some of these different communities might be to marginal seats like that?
Well, in Canterbury, you know, they could make the difference. You know, we all know there's going to be a fight for every vote. And, you know, last time around, the student vote was credited with helping Rosie Duffield win. It's difficult to assess the kind of the potential impact of that, other than to say that, you know, every vote is going to count in a way in Canterbury that doesn't necessarily apply in other constituencies.
The student vote, I mean, this was a conversation last time, wasn't it? It was the idea that the only way that Rosie won was because there's such a strong student population in Canterbury. You have three universities there. And the conversation swapped a little bit this time around because of the time of year that the election's taking place. We have December the 12th, which is traditionally right at the end of term for universities.
Major hangovers all around.
Major hangovers, yeah. Just final part of the term, yeah. Getting excited for Christmas. And there's the idea that where are the students going to be at that time? Are they going to have gone home? And are they going to have registered in the right places to vote? And will that actually affect the turnout for young voters?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you've touched on the issue there is that timing-wise, is possibly not going to have the same significance as it did last time around, you know, tie in with the fact that, you know, it's dark days, shorter daylight hours, and, you know, students nursing, you know, potential hangovers might be even less inclined to venture out. And as you say, you might actually have gone home by that stage. You know, university terms end on specific days, and it's not uncommon for students to disappear one or two days before that. So I don't know is the answer to it.
Yeah, so it's a good conclusion. I mean, who does know? You know, that's always our conclusion. But I mean, it's going to be interesting to see.
This is Talking Points, Kent's politics podcast.
So, Paul, Tunbridge Wells is another area that I think we wanted to briefly touch on.
Yes.
As a place of focus for the election.
Yes, well, on paper, it looks like a very safe seat for the Conservatives. And the incumbent MP, Greg Clark, is standing. And what's interesting about this seat is that the Liberal Democrats, who came third in 2017, regard it as, in jargon, as a seat in play.
Very sporty,
yes,
that.
Yes, which means effectively they think they've got an outside chance of causing an upset in the kind of same way that they did in Canterbury in 2017. Now, I was venturing out, or was planning to venture out to the constituency on Saturday to speak to a couple of people, including the Lib Dem candidate and the Labour candidate, but sadly got thwarted by poor train connections, so wasn't able to do my kind of research visits and chat to the candidates. I think, you know, my view is that the Lib Dems are, you know, nothing wrong with a bit of optimism and positivism, but I think it would be a pretty hard task to overturn the Conservative majority there. I mean, there's undoubtedly the demographics of Tunbridge Wells have changed in some ways, which, you know, favour perhaps the Lib Dems and Labour, but not to the extent that I would necessarily see them as springing a surprise victory. I mean, there's no student vote there for starters. But, you know, they're working it hard. The Liberal Democrat candidate, a guy called Ben Chaplard,
yeah.
Who is from a French background, he's actually a teacher, but he's taken a sabbatical to fight the campaign. But I have to say, I spoke to the Labour candidate over the phone, and they feel that they're the main contenders, and they've written a cheeky letter to the Lib Dems asking them to stand aside to allow them the best
more pacts.
More pacts, yeah. I mean, I think the other thing that's worth mentioning about Tunbridge Wells, it is one of these seats where the Lib Dems have forged a kind of non-aggression pact with the Greens, and the Greens are not standing. Don't think that's going to make a massive difference, though.
Mm. And actually, aside from Tunbridge Wells and Canterbury, we had a little bit of a look today at the number of candidates that are standing in the kind of male to female ratio of potential candidates. Were there much interesting there that tell us that much about the makeup of Kent's election?
I think, you know, I was going through my head before I actually got down to writing it all in a spreadsheet. And I thought the gender gap might be narrower than it was. And actually, when it totaled up, there were still, you know, majority of male candidates, 54, I think, to 32 female candidates. But, you know, interesting to see that the Conservatives, if they win Kent seats, will return, you know, a reasonable number of female MPs.
That's that hobnob there that's repeating on you there, Paul.
You'll have to fill in while I have it.
Yeah, and of course the national conversation and a lot of what we talked about last night is the number of female MPs that have decided to stand down on fear of kind of abuse. And
yeah,
like
I was,
that.
This is the other side of the coin, I guess. You know, so Sevenoaks, you know, if the Conservatives win Sevenoaks, which is, you know, probably going to happen, they will have a female MP. Obviously Canterbury with Rosie. And, you know, there are some existing Conservative MPs who stand every chance of getting re-elected.
Talking Points, Ken's Politics Podcast.
So last week I said that potentially we could be talking about manifestos today, Paul.
Yeah, you brought forward the publication date single-handedly by saying that the manifestos would be published.
That's how many people are listening to Talking
This is the power
points.
Of the podcast.
They are. They're already. Very powerful things. So, yeah, we haven't had any manifestos yet. We're still waiting on them. Any hints yet as to what
well,
the conversation's going to be around?
If I was a party, I'd probably have a kind of A4 side of a manifesto. I mean, the parties do love, you know, I think I mentioned this last week, they like to set out in detail, you know, what their commitments are going to be. And it will be another row about costings of expenditure. So you'll see the Conservatives attack Labour over its uncosted expenditure plans. And the Labour doing the same to the Conservatives. And I think, you know, if you went around and asked people what they remember from the manifestos in 2017, you'd draw a blank, basically. Even I can't remember what was in the manifestos of 2017.
And you're the political editor,
and
so help us all, you know.
Yes. So, yeah, manifestos will give another kind of interesting area. But the other interesting thing in terms of the campaign is the first potential leaders debate on Tuesday, I think, although that's being issued the caveat here if you're listening to this after Tuesday. Maybe it might not have taken place because the Lib Dems are going to court to get it stopped, saying it's not fair to exclude them from the leaders' debate.
It seems like every time we try and organise a timeline for things to talk about on this podcast, they get completely moved
that's,
or changed
that's
or
politics.
Swapped.
That's politics for you, it's election campaigns, yeah. So, I'm interested to see. I'm a big fan of these leaders' debates. I know it's kind of, they get schooled in delivering the kind of relevant sound bites that they think are going to hit the right targets. But, you know, they always have the potential for a kind of slip-up somewhere along the line or, you know, a misplaced phrase.
Do we think that's fair? I mean, I think a lot of voters are going to would rather watch an hour-long debate than go through every single manifesto for the parties.
Yeah, I would agree, definitely.
I mean, but at the same time, is it fair that if they slip up on something they say that they get completely reprimanded by the press the next day?
I mean, I think, you know, people who don't like the kind of TV debate side of it say it's we're becoming a bit more like America.
Like performative.
Know, yeah, mm. Where, you know, they kind of define the kind of the campaign and there's so much attention brought to them. And we haven't got that tradition. It's quite a new thing, relatively, in terms of UK politics. But I think more people are likely to tune in to that than to read manifestos. You know, whether it kind of whether it affects the overall results ultimately, I don't know, because it's a lot of the debate is about not making mistakes, not making the wrong sound bites and saying something off the cuff which gets misinterpreted. So in a sense, you know, when they first started, they were kind of slightly more kind of open in terms of discussion and parties perhaps didn't kind of rehearse quite as much as they do now. So there's a lot of preparation going on behind the scenes with, you know, role-playing for kind of conservatives to ask, you know, Boris difficult questions in the same Labour doing. So I think it is going to be an interesting debate, provided it takes place.
Mm. I guess to be confirmed on that, we may be talking about it next week, but we might not be.
Yes.
I did mention a cat earlier, cat standing. We haven't really talked about that. I don't know how much I'm going to actually mention it, but basically there's a cat standing in Gillingham and Rainham.
Yes.
So there's that.
There is a cat, which, you know, has generated lots of comments. It's not really a cat, we should say.
Well, no.
I tell you what, should we leave our readers, our listeners in suspense to say the way you're going to find out about the cat is go to Kent Online to see the full list of candidates.
That's another plug. That's two plugs in one podcast. What are we doing? It's good. It's good. It's very good. I mean, there's a couple of things to end on, a couple of lighthearted things. We're going to do a little thing where we talk about the things we don't like about campaigns, especially during the general election. You had one particularly that you got frustrated by.
Yeah, I've got this thing about the parties going out into constituencies, doing their canvassing and door knocking, and all saying they've had such a fantastic response from voters. It's been brilliant. Voters have told us they don't want Boris. Voters have told us they don't want Jeremy. And it's usually accompanied by a picture of happy canvassers brandishing placards. I just don't think it adds terribly much to the debate.
Would you prefer them to say, really bad reception today, it was raining and actually everyone slammed the door in my face?
Well, some have done that in the past. But I think it's one of these things which I'm not a fan of, in the same way I'm not a fan of politicians visiting hospitals or schools in order to kind of promote their campaigns. I just think, you know, it's kind of political graffiti, which doesn't really do anyone much, doesn't help anyone really in terms of deciding whether to vote one way or the other. But it just it clogs up my timeline.
Sure it probably does, as following all of the candidates as you probably are.
So yes, no, that's my one. This is my week two's dislike of the week.
There we go. Onto one more very popular segment. I say very popular, this is only the second time we've ever done it, but I'm sure everyone is itching to hear what your jargon of the week is.
Well, it's, yes, not quite jargon. It's
ruined it already, second
yeah,
week.
Yeah, extending the definition of what jargon is, but it's this phrase that's been used by Boris Johnson and other Conservatives about having an oven-ready chicken.
Go on. I'm hungry.
This is a metaphor for the Brexit deal, which they claim will deliver, the UK's withdrawal from the EU without any adverse consequences. Boris Johnson came up with it first. He talked about an oven-ready chicken, the deal being like an oven-ready chicken that you just put in the microwave. We're now
what?
Some culinary analysts have said that you shouldn't put a microwave at all. Dish into the oven, and they've not heard of chickens being put in. You'd have to have the microwave on for an awful long time.
On an oven setting, presumably. I mean, I don't imagine Boris Johnson has ever cooked an oven-ready chicken.
Well, we had that. This is another thing politicians are trying out now, is doing these video memes and little kind of inserts. Boris Johnson did one this week, or rather last week. Boris Johnson did one last week where he was seen answering all sorts of kind of questions to help him seem more human,
like the Vogue interview, wasn't it?
And which he was walking down a corridor and was asked what his favourite band was, and he said it was the Clash and the Rolling Stones. Then he said it was mainly the Rolling Stones, and then we saw him trying to make a cup of tea in the Conservative HQ kitchen. And it, you know, if you're a fan of tea, it looked like a particularly bad cup of tea. I didn't get any sense that he knew how to make a cup of tea properly, other than he'd seen someone pour some water into a cup and add some milk.
You think you'd prep that, wouldn't you, if you're going to go and do one of these videos where it's off the cuff and all that? You'd expect, make sure the PM knows how to make a tea, at the very least.
Although, you know, we would probably hate it if they stopped doing these things, because, you know, it's good entertainment value to us.
It gives us a lot to talk about and laugh at.
And in who can blame them for trying? I just don't think this one was a particularly successful one. And along with, I think the kind of metaphor of an oven-ready chicken is okay, you know.
I guess.
Why not an oven-ready lasagna or something like that?
Why go with...
It'd be Italian, wouldn't it? So...
Maybe that's what he's going. He's going for poultry, because he's saying it's
a UK thing, like roast dinner on a Sunday. You know, maybe he's going to change it to an oven-ready turkey by the time.
Yeah, Maybe. I think we're going far and far away from the metaphor when we do
that. We are, yes. But, yes, fewer tweets about people are saying they've had a fantastic reception, and fewer culinary illusions, I think, are...
What
the campaign needs.
Some good advice there from Paul Francis. Thank you so much for listening to our second episode of Talking Points. We'll be back next week with all the developments nationally and locally. My name's Oliver. This is Paul.
Thanks very much for listening, everyone. We'll see you. Well, we won't see you. We'll be with you next week.
Yeah, if we see you. Well, maybe we'll do a video cast next week then.
Yeah, we could. Oh, no. That would definitely lose us listeners.
Goodbye.
Talking Points, Kent's Politics Podcast.